little more than a chamber in which all six of the walls were screens, but the computer programs to run it were complex and expensive. It was a major outlay for the university and would have been totally impossible for the Subramanian family alone. "And," her mother said, passing Natasha her personal screen, "I have a picture of the group when they had a beach party a few weeks ago. They look like kids you might want to be friendly with."
"Huh,"
Natasha said, studying the score or so of young people displayed on the screen. She didn't comment on the fact that at least four of the boys in the picture were notably good-looking. Neither did her mother, although she was pretty sure that this unexpectedly reappearing Ron from Brazil wasn't nearly as handsome. "Of course," Myra said, "it's completely up to you, if you really feel you'd rather not." "Oh," Natasha said, "I suppose I could try it out once or twice. As you say, it'd make Suraj happy." When Bill returned to unite himself once more with his cluster of grand galactics, he wasn't prepared for the joyous rush of feeling that came with the experience. All the time he had been detached for the running of his various errands, he had been something that was not a part of his previous life experience. He had been alone. And then, once again joined to his fellows, he wasn't alone anymore, and he was jubilant. It was almost difficult for him to leave the cluster again. There wasn't any choice, of course. The cluster had shared his concerns and his need to be fair. Perhaps these wretched little humans no longer posed a threat to the galaxy's peace. If so, perhaps it was unfair to wipe them out. The Grand Galactics were always stern and sometimes ruthless, but they did not deliberately choose to be unfair. So Bill took the jumps that returned him to the neighborhood of the little yellow sun that their planet revolved around, and sent two messages. The first was to the 1.5 Armada, now only a small fraction of a light-year from the planet it had been instructed to depopulate. "Cancel instructions for depopulation," that message began. "Stop. Decelerate totally. Use emergency measures if necessary." And the second message was to the Armada, but also to the nine limbs themselves. It merely ordered that no further evidence of their presence should be given to the Earth humans, which made a small problem for the machine-stored operators of the Armada's 154 ships. They understood their orders, but those were much easier given than obeyed. In a spacecraft, you couldn't just slam on the brakes. There weren't any brakes. It was one thing to amp up the deceleration firing, which they did at once. That was terribly wasteful of electrical energy and working fluid, of course, but that didn't matter. Those commodities, like everything else in the observable universe, did, after all, belong to the Grand Galactics. If they chose to waste them, that was no one's business but their own. No, it was the second part of their instruction that troubled the 1.5s. They were commanded to avoid being observed by the subject species. But never mind that the nine limbs had already blown their cover. When the 1.5s were pouring gigajoules of energy into their exhausts, making a blazing beacon of ionized gases from 154 mammoth torches all firing at once, how could they remain unseen? Chapter 36. Preparing for the Race. Some people might have expected that the bon voyage party for the solar sail contestants would have been held in some giant auditorium in a city like New York or Beijing or Moscow. It wasn't. True, the cameras were there and everything that happened within their sight went out to the whole world's screens, but the place where the cameras were was only the terminal's little auditorium, and, counting everybody, the seven racers themselves, their handlers, their immediate families, and a very few VIP guests, there weren't more than 200 people in the room. Myra had her suspicions about why. No doubt, no two of the big three were willing to let the other one have the event. She said nothing, however. Then she caught a glimpse of her daughter, standing serious and tall with the other six contestants as a judge gave them a last-minute review of the rules of the race. "Doesn't she look good?" she whispered to her husband, knowing the answer. She got it. Ranjit had no more doubt than she that Natasha wasn't only the smartest and best of the solar sail pilots, but that she looked astonishingly, even a little worrisomely, mature for her 16 years. He focused on the most worrisome part of the scene. "There's that Brazilian Olsos standing right next to her," he pointed out to his wife. She squeezed his hand. "Ron's all right," she told him, with the wisdom that came with once having been a 16-year-old girl herself. And then, "Oh, hello, Joris." Vorholst got a hug from her, and the two men shook hands. "They're going to start in a minute," Vorholst told them. "I just wanted to say hello and to tell you that we've got a little pool going among the Skyhook engineers. My money's on Natasha." Myra said, "Is that what you engineers were getting excited about a little while ago?" Vorholst blinked at her. "Oh, that. No, it was an all-points message from the Sky Events Center in Massachusetts. There's been a hell of a bright supernova just observed in Centaurus, but it's got some funny features." He grinned. "Almost makes me wish I'd stayed with astronomy." And then, as the chairman of the event mounted the podium and all the members of the audience began the move toward their chairs, he said, "See you later." There was only one speaker at the ceremony, and that was the newly elected president of the Republic of Sri Lanka, Datusena Bandara. He looked presidential all right, with a strong old face and the slim figure of a man who had never let himself go soft. But what he said was informal, almost jocular. "There were several nations," he told the select few who were his audience, "who wanted this event to be held in some great city, but you are here. That isn't because my country is more deserving than any other. It's simply because, through the good fortune of geography, Sri Lanka is the site for the Skyhook. Without the Skyhook, this race could never be. It is the Skyhook that you 7 wonderful young men and women will board to take you to low Earth orbit. It was the Skyhook that carried each one of your spacecraft up to that point, piece by piece, and now those pieces are nearly completely assembled into the craft that you will fly in this greatest of all races. May God bless you all, and see you safely home when the race is over." And that was the end of it, except for the goodbye hugs and kisses before the pilots and their handlers moved toward the Skyhook loading platform. Ranjit observed, not with displeasure, that this Ronaldinho Olsos from Brazil was boarding the first capsule while Natasha was among those going in the third. When they had kissed Natasha goodbye for the 4th or 5th time, and had at last successfully untangled Robert from her arms, the remainder of the Subramanian family, like everyone else, began to head for the buses. There, squarely in their way, was Joris Vorholst, standing by himself and talking agitatedly into his pocket screen. "So, Joris," Myra said as they came up to him, "what are you worrying about now? Did they find another supernova?" Her tone was jocular. Vorholst's expression was not. He folded his screen shut and shook his head. "Not exactly. What they saw may not be a supernova at all, now that the space telescopes are lining up to get a good look at it, and it's a lot closer than any supernova should be. It may even be right in the Oort cloud." Myra stopped, her hand to her breast. "It isn't going to bother the racers?" Vorholst shook his head. "Oh, there's no danger of that, no. The solar sailors will be in low Earth orbit. This thing, whatever it is a long, long way from there. But I wish I knew what it was." Up where the solar sailors were nearly completely assembled, their riggers were not alone. No one saw the tiny spacecraft of the 9 limbs, because they had restored their photon shifters long since. But their 9-limbed crews were nearly as puzzled as Joris Vorholst, though about an entirely different matter. These 7 nearly completed sail ships, what were they for? They bore no sign of any kind of weaponry. That relieved the 9 limbs of one sort of worry, but another kind remained. None among the 9 limbs had any idea of what these spacecraft were up to, and that was not a fact that the 9 limbs wanted to report to their grand galactic masters. Chapter 37 The Race. Her ship's name was Diana, chosen by Natasha Subramanian herself. It had never flown. Now it was ready. It lay moored to its mother ship with its enormous disk of sails straining at the rigging, already filled with the great, silent wind that blew between the worlds. The race was ready to begin.
T-minus 2 minutes, said her cabin radio. Cross-check to confirm readiness.
One by one the other skippers answered. Natasha recognized every voice, some tense, some almost inhumanly calm, for they were the voices of her friends and rivals. In all of the places where humanity dwelt, there were scarcely a score of men and women who owned the skills needed to sail a sun yacht. Every one of them was here, at the starting line, like Natasha, or aboard the escort vessels orbiting 36,000 kilometers above Earth's equator.
Number one, Gossamer, ready to go.
Number two, Woomera, all okay.
Number three, Sunbeam, okay.
Number four, Santa Maria, all systems go.
Natasha smiled. That one was Ron Olsos, of course, whom she liked, though perhaps not as much as he seemed to like her. The Brazilian's reply had been an ancient echo from the early days of astronautics, typical of Ron's tendency toward the theatrical.
Number five, Lebedev, we're ready.
That was the Russian, Efremi.
Number six, Arachne, also okay.
Si Liang, the young woman from some village north of Chengdu in the shadow of the Himalayas. And then at the end of the line it was Natasha's turn to say the words that would be heard around the world and in every human outpost.
Number seven, Diana, ready to win.
And let old Ronaldinho take that, she thought, as she turned to make one last check of the tensions in her rigging. To Natasha, floating weightless in her tiny cabin, Diana's sails seemed to fill the sky. Well, it might. Out there, ready to take her free of Earth's gravitational bonds, were more than 5 million square meters of sail webbed to her command capsule by almost 100 kilometers of bucky-cord rigging. Those square kilometers of aluminized plastic sail, though only a few millionths of a centimeter thick, would exert enough force, she hoped, to put her first across the lunar orbit finish line. The wall speaker again.
T-minus 10 seconds, all recording instruments on.
Eyes still fixed on the vast billow of sail, Natasha touched the switch that turned on all Diana's cameras and instrument recorders. It was the sail that held her imagination. Something that was at once so huge and so frail was difficult for the mind to grasp. Harder still was to believe that this mirrored wisp could tow her ever faster through space by nothing more than the power of the sunlight it would trap.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, detach.
7 diamond-edged, computer-controlled knife blades sliced through 7 thin tethers at once. Then the yachts were free. Until this moment, yachts and servicing vessels had circled the Earth as a single unit, firmly held together. Now the yachts would begin to disperse, like dandelion seeds drifting before a breeze. And the one that first drifted past the orbit of the moon would be the winner. Aboard Diana, nothing among the senses of Natasha's body registered a change. She had not expected anything would. The only thing that showed that any thrust at all was being exerted was the dial on her instrument board, now registering an acceleration that was almost 1/1000th of one Earth gravity. That was, of course, almost ludicrously tiny. Yet it was more than any manned solar sail vessel had ever managed before, just as Diana's designers and builders had promised it would be. Such accelerations had never been achieved in any but toy-sized rigs, but there it was now. At this rate, she calculated quickly, smiled as the result appeared on her board, she would need only 2 circuits of Earth to build up enough velocity to leave low Earth orbit and head for the moon. And then the full force of the sun's radiation would be behind her. The full force of the sun's radiation. Natasha's smile persisted as she thought of all the attempts she had made to explain solar sailing to audiences of potential backers and the merely curious on Earth. "Hold your hand to the sun, palm up," she would tell them. "What do you feel?" And then, when there was no answer beyond, perhaps, a little heat, She would spring the rationale for solar sailing on them. But there is something else. There's pressure. Not much of it, no. In fact, so little that you can't possibly feel it, far less than a milligram's thrust on your palms. But see what that tiny pressure can do. And then she would pull out a few square meters of sail material and toss it toward her audience. The silvery film would coil and twist like smoke, and then drift toward the ceiling on the rising plume of warm air the human bodies made. And Natasha would continue, "You can see how light the sail is. The whole square kilometer my yacht will deploy weighs less than a ton. That's all we need. It's enough to collect 2 kilograms of radiation pressure, so the sail will start to move, and the rigging will pull my Diana right along with it. Of course, the acceleration will be tiny, less than 1/1000th of a G, but let's see what that pitiful little thrust can do. In the first second, Diana will move about 0.5 centimeter. Not even that much, really, because the rigging will stretch enough so that first move can't even be measured." She would turn toward the screen on the wall of the room, snapping her fingers to set it alight. It would display the vast, if almost impalpable, semi-cylindrical span of the sail, then zoom down to the passenger capsule, not much bigger than a motel shower stall, that would be Natasha's home for the weeks in transit. She would then go on. "After a minute, though, the motion is quite detectable. By then we've covered 20 meters, and our velocity has become nearly 1 kilometer per hour, with only a few 100,000 more kilometers to go to reach the orbit of the moon." Then there would often be a faint titter from the audience. Natasha would smile back good-naturedly until it had died away before going on. "That's not bad, you know. After the first hour, we'll be 60 kilometers from our starting point, and by then we'll be moving at 100 kilometers an hour. And please remember where we are. All of this will be taking place in space where there is no friction. Once you start something to move, it will move forever, with nothing slowing it down but the gravity of distant objects. You'll be surprised when I tell you what kind of velocity our 1/1000th of a G sailboat will be giving us by the end of its first day's run. Almost 3,000 kilometers an hour. All from the thrust of a sunlight pressure that you can't even feel." Well, she'd convinced them. In the end, the whole world had been convinced, or at least the people in high places, the decision-makers, had been. Foundations, individuals, the treasuries of 3 great nations, and smaller amounts from dozens of smaller treasuries, had come together to meet the staggering bills for this event. It was paying off, though. The free-flying race in that old lunar lava tube had successfully sparked a trickle of actual lunar tourism. Now this new event already owned the biggest audience in history, and the big boys were already commissioning their prospector vessels, many of them solar sail-driven themselves, to begin to investigate the raw material wealth of the solar system. And here was young Natasha de Souza Subramanian right in the middle of it all. Diana had made a good start. Now Natasha had time to take a look at the opposition. For starters, she shrugged out of most of her clothing, since there was no one else around to see. Then, moving very cautiously, there were shock absorbers between her control capsule and the delicate rigging of the sail, but Natasha was determined to take no risks at all, she stationed herself at the periscope. There the other spacecraft were, looking like strange silvery flowers planted in the dark fields of space. There was South America's Santa Maria, Ron Olsos at the helm, only 80 kilometers away. Santa Maria bore a close resemblance to a boy's kite, though a kite that measured more than 1 kilometer on a side. Beyond Santa Maria was the Russian Cosmodyne Corporation's Lebedev, looking like a Maltese cross. The theory, Natasha knew, was that the sails that formed its 4 fat arms could be used for steering purposes. In contrast, the Australian Woomera was a simple, old-fashioned round parachute, though one that was 5 kilometers in circumference. General Spacecraft's Arachne, as its name suggested, looked like a spider's web, and had been built on the same principles, by robot shuttles spiraling out from a central point. Eurospace's Gossamer was an identical design, though slightly smaller. And the People's Republic of China's Sunbeam was a flat ring with a kilometer-wide hole in the center, spinning slowly so that it was stiffened by a centrifugal force. That was an old idea, Natasha knew, but no one had ever made it work well. She was fairly sure the Asian vessel would have trouble when Sunbeam started to turn. That, of course, would not be for another 6 hours, after all seven of the solar yachts had moved through the first quarter of their 24-hour geosynchronous orbit. Here, at the beginning of the race, they were all headed directly away from the sun, running, as it were, before the solar wind. Each of them had to make the most of that first lap, before the laws of orbital motion swung them around Earth. When that point was reached, they would suddenly be heading directly back toward the sun. That was when expert pilotage would really count. Not now, though. Now Natasha had no navigational worries. With the periscope, she made a careful examination of her sail, checking each attachment point for the rigging. The shroud lines, narrow bands of unsilvered plastic film, would have been quite invisible had they not been coated with fluorescent dye. Now, in Natasha's periscope, they were taut lines of colored light dwindling away for hundreds of meters toward the gigantic span of the sail. Each line had its own little electric windlass, not much bigger than the reel on a fly fisherman's rod. The windlasses, computer-controlled, were constantly turning, playing lines in or out as the autopilot kept the sail trimmed to the correct angle to the sun. To Natasha, the play of sunlight on her great mirrored sail was beautiful to watch. The sail undulated in stately oscillations, sending multiple images of the sun marching across it until they faded at the edges. Those oscillations, of course, were not a problem. Such leisurely vibrations were inevitable in so vast and flimsy a structure, and usually quite harmless. Nevertheless, Natasha watched them carefully, alert for signs that they might ultimately build up to the catastrophic waves that were known as wriggles. Those could tear a sail to pieces, but her computer reassured her that the present pattern posed no danger. When she was satisfied that everything was shipshape, and not before, she allowed herself to access her personal screen. Since everything passed through the command craft before it got to her, and they were careful to pass on only messages from an approved list, she was spared the endless flood of good luck wishes and begging pleas for some favor or other. There was one message from her family, one from Gamini, and one from Joris Vorhulst. No more. She was glad to get them. None required any answer. Natasha thought for a moment of going to sleep. Of course, the race had just started, but sleeping was something she needed to ration adequately to herself. All the other yachts had two-person crews. They could take turns asleep, but Natasha Subramanian had no one to relieve her. That had been her own decision, of course, remembering that other solitary sailor, Joshua Slocum, who long ago had single-handedly taken his tiny sailboat, Spray, around the world. If Slocum could do it, she maintained, she could. There was a good reason to try it, too. The performance of a sun yacht depended inversely on the mass it had to move. A second person, with all her supplies, would have meant adding another 300 kilos, and that could easily have been the difference between winning and losing. So Natasha snapped the elastic bands of the cabin seat around her waist and legs. She hesitated for a moment. It might be interesting, she thought, to look in on some of the news broadcasts, particularly to see if any astronomer had yet made any sense of that peculiar not-a-supernova that had blossomed astonishingly bright in the southern sky and then simply disappeared. Discipline won out over curiosity. She placed the electrodes of the sleep inducer onto her forehead, set the time for 3 hours, and relaxed. Very gently, the hypnotic pulses throbbed in the frontal lobes of her brain. Colored spirals of light expanded beneath her closed eyelids, widening outward to infinity. Then nothing. What dragged Natasha back from her dreamless sleep was the brazen clamor of the alarm. Instantly she was awake, her eyes scanning the instrument board. Only 2 hours had passed, but above the accelerometer a red light was flashing. Thrust was failing. The Diana was losing power. Training brought discipline. Discipline prevented panic. Nevertheless, Natasha's heart was in her mouth as she cast off her restraining straps to act. Her first thought was that something had happened to the sail. Perhaps the anti-spin devices had failed, and the rigging was twisting itself up. But as she checked the meters that read out the tensions of the shroud lines, what they told her was strange. On one side of the sail, the meters were reading normally. On the other, the value was dropping slowly before her eyes. Then understanding came. Natasha grabbed the periscope for a wide-angle scan of the edges of the sail. Yes, there was the trouble. And it could have come from only one cause. The huge, sharp-edged shadow that had begun to slide across the gleaming silver of Diana's sail told the story. Darkness was spreading over one edge of Natasha's ship, as though a cloud had passed between her and the sun, cutting off light, putting a stop to the tiny pressure that drove the craft. There were no such clouds in space. Natasha grinned as she swung the periscope sunward. Optical filters clicked automatically into position to save her from instant blindness, and what she saw was precisely what she had expected to see. It looked as though a giant boy's kite were sliding across the face of the sun. Natasha recognized the shape at once. 30 kilometers astern, South America's Santa Maria was trying to produce an artificial eclipse for Natasha. "Ha, Señor Ronaldinho Ulsos," Natasha whispered, "that's the oldest trick in the book." So it was, and a perfectly legal one, too. Back in the days of ocean racing, skippers had done their best to rob opponents of their wind. But only the incompetents were caught that way, and incompetent Natasha de Souza Subramanian was not. Her tiny computer, the size of a matchbook but the equivalent of 1,000 human number-crunching experts, considered the problem for a brief fraction of a moment and quickly spat out course corrections. Two could play at that game. Grinning, Natasha reached out to disable the autopilot and make the adjustments to the trim in her rigging. That didn't happen. The tiny windlasses stayed frozen. Suddenly they were receiving no orders at all, either from the autopilot computer or from the human being that should have been controlling everything. Solar yacht Diana was no longer underway. The vast sail began to tip, and then to bend, and then the ripples in the fabric began to grow into great, irregular billows, and the flimsy material that was the sail reached and passed its maximum tolerated stress. The Commodore saw at once that Diana was in trouble. Indeed, the whole fleet did, and radio discipline evaporated in a flash. Ron Olsos was the first to demand a chemical-powered tender to take him off his own ship so that he could help search for Natasha Subramanian in the collapsing ruin that had been the space yacht Diana. He wasn't the last. Within another hour, the race had dissolved into more than a score of vessels of all kinds, milling about the crumpled mass that had once been beautiful Diana, doing their best to avoid colliding with one another. The spacecraft that possessed the capability of man-in-space technology suited up as many of their crews as they could and searched. They searched every fold of the immense, crumpled sail. Visually, when they had to, and with infrared viewers when those were present. These viewers would instantly pick up the tiny signal of a warm human body anywhere in the destroyed sail. They searched all the space around destroyed Diana, on the chance that somehow Natasha had been flung free through some unknown accident. Above all, they searched Diana's tiny cabin. That didn't take long. With only herself aboard, there was no need for privacy. Diana's capsule amounted to only a few cubic meters of space, and no possible place to hide. But she wasn't there. As far as the searchers could tell, Natasha Subramanian wasn't anywhere at all. Chapter 38. The Hunt for Natasha Subramanian. What the 3/4 of the Subramanian family that remained on Earth had resolved to do was carry on with as normal a life as was possible, with the other quarter of the family gallivanting through cislunar space in a contraption of plastic and buckyball carbon. Accordingly, once they had sent Natasha their final good luck message, Ranjit had got on his bike to head for his office. Myra had seen the possibility of a whole hour, maybe two, for her to try to catch up on what her increasing backlog of journals had to say about some of the hotter subjects in the area of AI and prostheses. Such gifts of a few personal hours were not frequent. They came when young Robert was asleep, or when he was at his special school, or when he was, as now, dutifully following the housemaid around, helping her, or, more accurately, quote, helping her, with her early morning tasks of making beds and tidying rooms. So, with a cooling cup of tea on the table before her, and of course with the news programs playing on her room screen in case, however improbably, something unexpected occurred in Natasha's race, Myra was trying to make sense of some of her journals when she heard the sound of her son's heartbroken sobbing. She looked up and saw the maid carrying him into the room.
"I don't know what happened, missus," the maid said, sounding struck. "We were emptying out the wastebaskets when Robert suddenly sat down and began to cry. Robert never cries, missus."
Which Myra, of course, knew as well as she did. But there it was. So Myra did what untold billions of other mothers have done, all the way from the Australopithecines. She took her son in her arms and rocked him soothingly, murmuring into his ear. It didn't stop the crying, no, but the tears simmered down to sobs. Myra was asking herself whether this unusual and troubling, but certainly not life-threatening, development warranted calling her husband at his office when there was a stifled shriek from the maid. Myra looked up. There, on the screen, was the image of her daughter's solar yacht. Apart from the fact that one edge was ever so slightly tipped up, it looked exactly as it had an hour earlier, but now there was a red banner underneath the image that said, "Accident in Lunar Race?" And when the audio volume was turned up, there was no question mark in the agitated remarks of the newscaster. Something bad had happened to Diana. Worst of all, Diana's pilot, which was to say Myra's beloved daughter, was not answering distress calls from the Commodore, and it seemed that whatever had gone wrong with the solar yacht had somehow abducted its pilot. Myra Subramanian's terrible worry was perhaps the most personal distress anyone in the world can feel, but she